I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, just when you thought he was down for the count, Dr. Jordan Peterson, the controversial Canadian psychologist turned YouTube star and self-help guru, on a seemingly messianic crusade to rescue alienated young men from the bowels of nihilism, vis-a-vis the apparently profound wisdom of lobsters, has resurfaced. Dr. Peterson went from the status of relatively obscure academic to a worldwide media sensation almost overnight after he began railing against the excesses of political correctness on university campuses. According to Peterson, youths attending classes in the hallowed halls of academia are being seduced by an ideology of postmodern neo-Marxism that is leading Western civilization down the road to ruin. He then added to this apocalyptic message a heavy dose of self-help advice coupled with quasi-evangelical preaching claiming to attest to the deeper, more profound meaning of such subjects as lobster fights and Disney's The Lion King, all the while admonishing young people for not having their own rooms in order before critiquing society. Never mind that no one ever has their room fully in order, least of all, apparently, Peterson himself. You see, after the best-selling success of his book, 12 Rules for Life, news broke that the Canadian psychologist was suffering from a benzo addiction. Of course, that is not to say that Peterson should be mocked for struggling with an addiction issue. However, it is indicative of the good doctor not following his own rules. Despite this, it appears that Peterson is mounting a comeback, having just appeared on his daughter Michaela's podcast and penning an article for the National Post attacking activist culture. Joining us on this edition of Parallax Views to revisit the critique of Jordan Peterson is Conrad Hamilton, one of the co-authors of the recent Zero Books title, Myth and Mayhem: A Leftist Critique of Jordan Peterson. A note before we dive into the conversation: this particular discussion was actually recorded a few months ago at the height of the coronavirus lockdown. However, I believe the content remains evergreen. And with that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Conrad Hamilton, co-author of Myth and Mayhem, a leftist critique of Jordan Peterson. Welcome to Parallax Views, Conrad Hamilton, co-author of Myth and Mayhem, a leftist critique of Jordan Peterson. How are you doing today, Conrad? I am asking a lot more how everyone's doing when they come on the show just because of this COVID-19 mayhem.
Yeah, I'm doing okay. I'm in a 15 square meter apartment in Paris, so it's a little bit like, being in prison on the downside. But on the plus side, it's a bit like being in prison in Goodfellas where you can, go and make food, right?
So this book, Myth and Mayhem, you're one of the co-authors. The book also features Ben Burgess, mm-hmm. Matt McManus, and Mirion Trejo. So this is sort of like a collaborative effort available now from Zero Books. What led to this project coming together? Jordan Peterson, it seems like he's in a weird sort of space right now, but I think there's something interesting about, addressing him head on still.
Mm-hmm. The project, it was kind of a confluence of events. A friend of mine, Greg Talon, who actually did the art for the book's cover and build the website. It's very, really nice art, if you've seen it. He had been involved online, creating certain groups on Facebook, and sort of responding to, Peterson's influence with kind of, meme content that parodied him and so forth. Greg had sort of alerted me, to the kind of Peterson phenomenon, because it wasn't something, I'm in France, I'm doing academic stuff here. It wasn't something I was so cognizant of. A little bit later, I did a chapter for a book that Matt put out on Zero called What is Postmodern Conservatism? Not to be confused with his monograph on that subject by Macmillan, Rise of Postmodern Conservatism. And Matt indicated his intention to me to write a book on Peterson. He proposed that I be involved. And initially I was actually I tried to put it off. I was a little bit ambivalent about it because, I wasn't sure, if it would be a good idea to engage with Peterson in that kind of way. I had two maybe revelations, that persuaded me to get involved in the book. And one was, I was reading about Peterson and the kind of influence he'd had, and I'd already seen a few of his videos, but I saw that 12 Rules for Life, for example, I think it had sold 3 million copies or at that point. And my first thought was, maybe you can argue that, I think it's very clear, actually, that the sort of left kind of outrage culture, and the responses that were issued did have the effect of building up Peterson's career at a certain point. But I think he, by that time he'd already kind of arrived, maybe on that basis he warranted a more rigorous response. I also, people often talk about, legitimizing certain authors. And then I also kind of had a moment of humility and I thought, well, I'm not going to fucking legitimize anyone, but that's not an effect I feel like I would really have. So, those two things persuaded me to be involved. And I said to Matt, I'll do it. The condition I laid out was just that I wanted to make an equal contribution to the book as he would.
I guess. So I'm gonna maybe give an adversarial take on Peterson, mm-hmm. and sort of addressing him. I don't think debating him is bad. I don't agree with the legitimization argument, but it was weird. Someone was saying to me recently, oh, Peterson was so popular up until Zizek. And I said, it's true that 12 Rules for Life sold really well, but I'm not sure that everyone who read 12 Rules for Life actually necessarily lives their life through Peterson's political ideology. I guess to me, that's a little bit of idealism. And in a way, mm-hmm. more and more I've been questioning how important Peterson really is. Sometimes I think the left almost makes him more important than he really is. Like I said, he may be a best-selling author, but I'm not sure when people put down that book that they live their life in the exact way he tells them to. It's almost like he's a self-help guru, and he'll put some politics in, but I'm not sure that I think people live their lives based more on material conditions than ideas. Does sure. that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I'm just curious if you would want to respond to that. Well, why do you think Peterson, it's still maybe important to address him?
Why do I think, in light of the fact perhaps that people don't necessarily live their lives on that basis?
Yeah, I'm just curious what your take on that would be. I'm not trying to be too yeah. adversarial about it, but I'm just curious.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that one of the things that's interesting about it, you know, is because, you know, I think there's a bit of a difference in the way Matt and I sort of approach the material, because I think, you know, Matt has a pretty good faith approach when he deals with authors. And I think, you know, I'm a bit more evil, right? But, I think, you know, he really had a strong tendency to confront, the arguments really head on. Now, I did a fair bit of that in the book. I certainly do that. But I was also, in fact, I was more interested, in Peterson, as a cultural phenomenon in many respects than purely as an intellectual per se. And that reflects in our citations. So for example, I read, you know, everything Peterson had written of note before doing this quite thoroughly.
Wait. You read Maps of Meaning in its entirety? I'm sorry.
I did. Yeah, I did read that. Yeah, I saw the all those Tolkien-esque diagrams of the Dragon of Chaos or whatever that are just pointlessly interspersed throughout the book.
I had trouble reading it after like the first page where he quotes the Bible and he says, "I am going to show you things that have been hidden from you since the foundation of the world." And I'm like, oh, this guy's like sort of, you know, a whacked out mystic. But maybe I'm not taking him seriously enough.
Yeah, I think, you know, and that book's really, really problematic in the sense that he never adequately grounds the association he's attempting to develop between Jungian archetypes or complexes and his suggestion of their kind of neurobiological basis. Right. And in fact, a lot of the mythological stories that he uses, that he cites as archetypal and embedded, you know, in kind of the neurobiological structure of the brain and so forth, in fact, are, you know, should we consult the anthropological record, are in fact more historically particular than Peterson's account would tend to admit. So there are some problems with that. But so this reflects in the citations. So like Matt will... you know, he tended to engage a bit more with Maps of Meaning. I did engage with Maps of Meaning because, you know, you have to have it as a foundation. But where possible, I preferred to cite 12 Rules for Life, because I think 12 Rules for Life was, you know, really the moment where, I mean, he kind of arrived in 2016, but that was the first, you know, if you want to call it a philosophical text, it's kind of a, you know, airport licensed self-help book as well.
I think we have a lot in common with how we view Peterson.
Yeah. Well, so I tended to cite that, but to get back to your question, I guess I was interested in, you know, I mean, the first chapter I start out, and Matt has an account of Peterson's kind of origins that really helps elucidate his thought, you know, and I have a kind of parallel take where I discuss, you know, the way that he was given a great deal of support from both governmental institutions, ironically, and the right-wing media. And how there was an obvious kind of obsession, you know, with the idea of building his kind of cult of personality that manifested at a certain point. I mean, I think 12 Rules for Life, there was no, I mean, I could be mistaken. I don't think there was any like hands-on philosophical academic editing. But one of the editors was a former student of Peterson's who had written a book, Orphan X, about a trained orphan assassin that was a bestseller and that they're going to adapt into a Hollywood film soon. With like Ryan Gosling or something. So, you know, I mean, you can see this, right? Like Peterson was very, very concerned with how do I make this lateral move? And, you know, I mean, the chapter I wrote is called From the Lecture Hall to Hollywood. So I think again, I was interested in exploring it as a cultural phenomenon and as something symptomatic, you know, of the ascent of the alt-right in our time. And it seems like whenever far-right movements, you know, kind of gain in power, there's an effort for them to acquire a kind of intellectual legitimation. So, you know, you can take the extreme of like the Nazi regime and Heidegger or something like that. I'm not saying Peterson is a Nazi obligatory statement. But I think now you can see that whatever else you can say about Peterson, he's a lot better than like Milo Yiannopoulos or something, right? So I think his very existence, like the fact this is a guy who taught at Harvard, he's tenured at the University of Toronto, he's spouting a lot of ideas that are genetically similar, let's say, to ideas put forth by the alt-right or men's rights activists or whatever. I think his existence in of itself and the prestige he commands attest to that that sort of organizational and ideological strengthening.
You know, I want to get into the part of the book that you wrote, part two, Peterson's Reckoning with the Left. And you mentioned chapter six from the lecture hall to Hollywood. But I'd like that other part of the title, Peterson's Showbiz Roots. And real briefly, I'm just going to say, the more and more I looked at Peterson, I interviewed Dr. Bernard Schiff, who helped him get a job at the University of Toronto. I quickly came to the impression that Peterson is someone that came from a very rural, sort of conservative area of Canada. And he seems like a bit of almost like a Rasputin character, very like quasi mystical. And in a way that ties into the showbiz connection, because he's very reminiscent of a holy roller or a televangelist. So maybe we could get into those showbiz roots and what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, what I discuss in it is that, I mean, first of all, I think the real power of Peterson, you know, and where I think he's indisputably great is as an orator, you know, and I just consider this incontestable. I mean, he's extremely effective, right? And I love the way that, you know, when he speaks, he kind of, you know, he will actually stop and kind of, you know, seem like he's almost in a state of agony. You know, like there's something so profound he's trying to bring forth that it almost hurts him to do so. And I think, you know, I mean, I think if you want to understand the evolution of Peterson's career, this is very important, right? Because when he was at Harvard, you know, I mean, I don't, he taught at Harvard. You know, he ultimately did not get tenure there. But it was very interesting because while he was denied tenure, he won a student selected prize for best teacher. Right. So, again, I think he always had this kind of show stopping quality that greatly exceeded, you know, the academic credibility of his works. He was later hired at U of T. U of T, you know, had skepticism, the hiring commission, about him. It was Bernard Schiff's intervention. And I think Schiff may have stressed his utility for students that caused him to be hired there. And then, you know, if you look at U of T, I mean, he only began his ascent, you know, it wasn't because of credibility in academic publication. I mean, obviously he has a certain credibility because he taught at Harvard and then he was tenured at U of T. So you have to have certain, you know, instances of clinical work or whatever to get there. But, you know, it wasn't outstanding recognition academically that caused his profile to be built up. I mean, the first big thing was that he met a Polish immigrant television producer who worked for TVO, TV Ontario, which is a fully or partly publicly funded, you know, broadcasting outlet. And he, you know, and this is actually described in the beginning of 12 Rules for Life. When he met Peterson, he had the, you know, sort of immediate impression of having met someone whose presence would be perfect for camera. Right. So he was thinking of it through kind of a cinematographic lens. Right. He agreed to do a number of episodes, right, that he broadcast on TVO on Maps of Meaning. So I think there was like a, I don't know how many parts, like 13 part series or something that aired. And then later Peterson sort of parlayed that, into, subsequent appearances on different TVO programs, like, The Agenda with Steve Paikin, which has a broad viewership, which is great, you know, cause Paikin just looks like befuddled a lot of the time when Peterson's speaking. Like, you know, like Peterson will be talking about Avatar or something, and he'd be like, but the thing about Cameron is he has no appreciation for technology. you know, no appreciation for Western civilization, you know, this kind of thing. Like, you know, he goes on a panel with feminists, and one of the women remarks that he sounds like a 1970s issue of Cosmopolitan magazine, which tells you a great deal about our culture, that his observations about relationships today are widely viewed as incredible. You know, and then after that, he describes how so he got a lot of visibility off that. And after that, he describes how he basically came up with the premise of 12 Rules for Life, because he was like, he just got really into throwing things on Quora and seeing how many views they would get on Quora. And I guess he made a list of like 50 rules you should live your life by, and it had a really positive response. And then he thought, well, if this is doing so well on Quora and all my students know it, then maybe I should adapt it into a book. You know, and then eventually the list became kind of weaned down. I mean, you know, and then again, like, you know, the kind of position he took in the scandal in 2016, I mean, he really misrepresented the facts.
What was that scandal for listeners that may be a little bit unfamiliar? Because, I mean, I feel like everyone has, you know, shortened attention spans in our digital age.
Sure, sure. It's like 2016. It's like, man, it's just painting in a cave back then, right? Peterson published a video, Professor Against Political Correctness. So that was, again, I don't have my fact sheet here, but that was, I believe, in response to Bill C-16, which was a federal bill that was intending to provide constitutional protections for gender expression and identity. Peterson had this video, and he was a professor at the University of Toronto, had this video, and he talked about how, you know, this sort of human rights regime was so, you know, kind of totalitarian, right? That he was seriously concerned, you know, that were he to teach the things he wants to teach, that he would be thrown in prison, right? Or say the things he wanted to say. And he said that I refuse to, you know, submit to public regulation about how I should use gender pronouns. I'm going to say this for the Peterson fans out there, because they always, you know, you always have to mention this detail to appease them, that Peterson said, it's not that I personally wouldn't address someone by their chosen pronouns, that I object to the legislation. But, you know, there were a number of problems. And actually, in that video, by the way, he insinuates that there may be some kind of conspiracy at work, because the premier of Ontario at the time was a lesbian. He remarks that, you know, she seems to be, you know, very favorable to this kind of SJW agenda. But there were a number of issues with this, right? In fact, Peterson's, there's possibly a bit of jurisdictional ambiguity here, but my understanding is that universities in Canada, right, they're provincially regulated. And I think Ontario had similar legislation for like 5 or 7 years. Also, you can't go to prison, right? That's not a penalty that can be meted out were you to engage in hate speech. And moreover, a lot of, you know, there were certain lawyers who weighed in the matter. And I think, you know, a lot of people said that not using a desired pronoun wouldn't at all meet the threshold for what would be described as hate speech in the first place. Right. You know, that would be more like sort of like aggressive Holocaust denial or something. Right. Though, again, there's a range of interpretations there. So there were certain factual misrepresentations that he engaged in. But, you know, it didn't really matter. You know, that didn't really come out in a big way. See, the next step here is you have to ask yourself how he became so popular at that point, right? What happened is there's a paper in Canada, the National Post, and it was founded in the 90s by Conrad Black, who was later charged and imprisoned for corporate corruption. And he's written some, you know, he's a conservative. He's written some decent books, like on Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Maurice Duplessis and so forth. But he founded the paper explicitly with the goal of shifting Canada's media environment to the right. You know, it's lost money for years and years. You know, it's got a strong connection with oil companies in Canada, and in turn, of course, to the political right. You know, and they came out and they just, you know, they gave Peterson, you know, they just this really, really hyperbolic kind of coverage, right? They hailed him as, you know, a breath of fresh air, and, you know, the intellectual who's arrived here to save us, you know, from these horrible left-wing apparatchiks and all this. But very few of them, you know, what's interesting about the articles they write is that very few of the people, you know, they have the whole sort of all-star roster of writers in the National Post weighing in on this. Very few of them, you know, even, you know, made the most tangential effort to check the factual record in terms of the kind of claims he was making. So, you know, there was that inflation of his sense of importance, and then you had a kind of groundswell online. You know, and that he kind of parlayed that. But it's just interesting because I said at every step of his career, you know, there's been his career was basically, you know, through TVO and through the universities, it was basically built out of public funding. I mean,
he basically, in a way, it wasn't in a way, this is not just some grassroots phenomena. He had institutions that helped him through this.
Very much so. Yeah, no, I mean, it's one thing to speak of the media, right? You know, and in many cases, you know, different media outlets are the recipients of public subsidies. But I said this is very, very explicit. If we're talking about, you know, TVO or the university system, and it's quite funny, right? Because he often talks about how, you know, he talks about how he was such a victim in academia because of, you know, how that his views were construed as bizarre, you know, or he didn't fit the sort of postmodern neo-Marxist consensus. And I mean, I can sort of understand this in a way, because when he says postmodern neo-Marxist, of course, his main reference point has nothing to do with Marxism. I mean, that's just a way of kind of demonizing, you know, it's mostly to do with sort of post-structuralist, more, kind of libertarian left ideas, which are commonplace in a university context, or certainly were when he was ascending, right? You know, and it may be true that, you know, in the course of his career that you know, he experienced certain mild setbacks because of, you know, his lack of conformity to those ideas. But at the same time, you know, it's interesting because if we're talking explicitly about something like Marxism, right, I would find it very, very unlikely that the government or these powerful institutions, you know, in a place like Ontario where I'm from, would ever give that kind of support, right, to someone with those ideas. So, you know, and you see this is kind of the thing, right? Like, you know, he'll rail against affirmative action. I mean, look at his debate with Zizek, right? It's like, whatever you can say about Zizek, I mean, this guy was translating Derrida when he was 23 years old. He's a real philosophic pedigree. You know, no one, you know, however kind of showman-like he is, I don't think anyone disputes that he has very strong credentials. And you compare that to Peterson. I mean, this is just a guy who, you know, I'm not saying he's dumb, right? But this is just a guy who basically, you know, wrote a self-help book peppered with Nietzsche references, you know, and was propelled forth by the right-wing media, you know, whipped up kind of a campaign, you know, and now he's on a stage debating with Zizek. I mean, this is like the affirmative action of the right, right?
Interesting because Peterson he talks about how victimhood culture is so bad, but he himself sort of talks of himself as a victim of the postmodern neo-Marxist conspiracy. I always found it interesting, by the way, just briefly, he used to say cultural Marxism, and I noticed he switched over to postmodern neo-Marxism, and I suspect that's because cultural Marxism, it's basically a paleo-conservative, like Pat Buchanan, it's a code word, or a dog whistle, yeah, for a Judeo-Bolshevik sort of conspiracy. It's an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. But he switched over that term very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure of the lineage of the, like, I have heard him use the word cultural Marxism. I wasn't aware that there was like a chronological point at which there was a shift. That's quite possible. And you may be right. I was mostly working off postmodern neo-Marxism as a term, because that's the one that he explicates clearly, right, in 12 Rules for Life.
I guess, though, getting back to – I went off into a tangent there. There is sort of this – he'll talk about people building identities around victimhood, but, mm-hmm, I mean, that's sort of what his career has been based on as well.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it's very interesting on that level because, like, again, you know, has he experienced a certain level of, you know, professional discrimination for not being exactly in the academic mainstream, like possibly, right? Again, I stress that, you know, were he like an out and out Marxist, it probably would have been considerably worse, right? But I think, you know, it's interesting because it seems to me that one thing people often underestimate in terms of its importance is how much Peterson's worldview is shaped through his exposure to universities, You know, so he'll talk about, you know, and Matt sometimes brings this up, right? He'll talk about, you know, kind of the menace posed by, you know, SJWs and you know, really sort of, you know, trump up the significance of, for example, the kind of legislative items that he was discussing in 2016. But, you know, one thing that's often lost in this is any sense of perspective whatsoever. I mean, look at the tremendous kind of sweeping victories that have been achieved by the alt-right in the last few years. You know, and we can start with kind of Brexit and Trump and go down the line, right? You know, so I think Peterson at one point he admitted, he said, well, maybe my perspective, you know, is shaped a little bit by the fact I'm in universities, right? I guess what I mean is like, you know, in terms of this kind of, like, I would interpret postmodern neo-Marxism as really, you know, should we extract it from kind of ideology, I would think of it, you know, as being a critique of kind of the hegemony of, let's say, post May 68 kind of liberalism, right? You know, again, he doesn't, you know, there's not a proportional representation of the importance of those things. And he will criticize, right, the alt-right. Sometimes he does do this, right? Usually his criticism is that, you know, the alt-right resemble the left, you know, in terms of their attachment to identitarian categories, right? But at the same time, Peterson's really interesting this way because, you know, he kind of, there's always the sense when he's talking about the alt-right, where he's like, oh, well, you sort of have it right. You're just a bit off, right? Like, so you see him, and I could go into more on this, but I'll give you a very, very easy example. He was on Matt Lewis in the News, and he was talking about, you know, Trump and Hillary. You know, and he goes, they asked him who he would vote for if he was an American. And he says, well, you know, I'm more of an order guy. So I think, you know, I would have went for Hillary, you know, but maybe when I got in the booth at the last minute, you know, I would have went for Trump. That's this kind of thing. And this actually has to do, I could get more into this, but maybe you don't want me to get, go too deep into the kind of, philosophical analysis, but,
I'd be very interested if you got into that because I found that interesting. You mentioned the 2016 election because I remember he was on Bill Maher, when 12 Rules for Life came out, and he was talking about Trump supporters, and he was like, we need to stop browbeating them. They are people too. And I'm like, so if we criticize Trump supporters, that's bad, but it's okay to criticize the SJW people hard on. It just seems like there's contradictions there. So I'd really be interested in getting into the philosophical underpinnings of what you're talking about.
Well, what I would say is this. You know, I always like to go to this because it's the example I use in the second chapter of my contribution to the book. But there's a talk. Peterson has described himself as a classic British liberal before. You know, normally liberalism, you know, is based on a certain axiomatic assumption about certain equal qualities that are bestowed to all individuals, right? You know, so there's a lecture Peterson gives, and he's asked about IQ, right? You know, and he kind of looks really serious, right? He goes, I don't like talking about this because as soon as you talk about this, they kill you, right? Of course, but of course, he's Peterson, so he does talk about it. What he says is he basically he says, well, IQ may not be perfect, but it's the best thing we have. And then it's a really Petersonian move because he diverts the question into a discussion about like the public understanding of statistics. And he says, we have a problem here where, you know, what he calls the tail problem, where he says, you know, what people don't appreciate is that like, if you ask, well, are men or women more aggressive, right? There's not a big difference on average between men and women. But the margin of difference that exists manifests very strongly at extremes. So if you take like the 1 in 100 of people who's the most aggressive, it's invariably male. And he brings this up now, and then he proceeds to bring up a very politically correct example, of race and IQ. And he talks about how Ashkenazi Jews have higher IQs than other groups. You know, and then he kind of, you know, he kind of loops this all around, right? So in a way, it's like a roundabout sort of approval of the idea that, yeah, okay, there are some groups that, you know, he brackets it off from social context in a way that, you know, isn't so credible, but he has this kind of roundabout way of approving, well, okay, yeah, it does seem that we can say some racial groups are, you know, superior to others at the level of IQ. But then, like, at the very end, right, he does this thing, because in Peterson, you always get this moment of disavowal, right? And at the very end, he says, but just because some people are more capable than others doesn't mean you should treat them differently, right? And I think we have to talk a little bit here about Carl Jung, right? Because, you know, again, I said that most liberal philosophy is characterized by a certain assumption of a certain level of equal capacity that's distributed. You know, Peterson's whole lecture about IQ is explicitly against that. I mean, he talks about how the U.S. military won't hire individuals with IQs, I think, under 83, and how that's 10% of the population, and how, you know, we've deceived ourselves into thinking everybody can do things and get ahead, but we haven't acknowledged that, you know, there are 10% of people whom we just have to, we don't really know. We have to figure out what use they can be or what they can do. So it's explicitly anti-egalitarian. So I want to say in a Jungian vein, I mean, Jung said, I believe nature is aristocratic and exoteric, but I'm still an inveterate Democrat, right? Well, how can that contradiction exist, right? This is the question we have to ask. How can Peterson, you know, on one hand have this very, very autarkic view of nature, but on the other hand still describe himself as a liberal? And, you know, in psychoanalysis, we always get this kind of disarticulation, right? You know, obviously id, ego, superego, consciousness, unconscious, all of this. And I think, you know, Jung talked about the importance of religion, not even on the basis that religion was true, right? But on the basis that, you know, it enriches people's lives or allows for the development of the self when you have this kind of thing to believe in, right? So for Freud, religion was like an outmoded collective neurosis, but for Jung, it was something, you know, very instrumentally useful in the crucial process of self-development, regardless of its factuality. And I think that's basically the way that Peterson understands, you know, his own, that's how he approaches his own liberalism, right? So Peterson's basic view is that, like, you know, a certain assumption of equality may benefit a society, but in fact, this is sort of an illusion because capacities are so wildly unequally distributed that we could never, you know, we could never ever achieve, you know, anything resembling real equality. And, you know, should we attempt to achieve that, the only outcome can be totalitarianism, which, of course, he's obsessed with in this very, you know, camp Canadian kind of way. But actually, and that gets to another point about Peterson, which is interesting, which is that, again, you know, you get a lot of kind of right wing thinkers and the argument they make about capitalism is they say, well, they'll say, well, it's unfortunate that capitalism is so unequal, but, you know, at the same time, it's produced, you know, this is a very standard argument. You know, it's had the net effect of enriching all of humanity, right? So the equality is something we ought to endure. That, you know, that's the irony of that argument itself is that, you know, it would have never had the net effect of, let's say, enriching the quality of life anyway, were it not for, you know, leftist redistributive initiatives. But anyway, putting that aside, what's interesting about Peterson is he actually likes inequality in capitalism. Like, because, you know, he talks about in 12 Rules for Life, he says, like, well, and likes, I have to qualify, but he talks about it in 12 Rules for Life and he talks about Price's Law and the Pareto Principle. And he says, well, look, you know, nature is savage and inequitable. You know, when we remember the history of classical music, we only remember a small number of scores. So he puts forth this kind of ontological notion that, you know, inequality is just part of the structure of reality, right? Like right down to kind of the ontological core of nature. You know, and so for him, capitalism has a kind of representative function of that, right? And its great merit stems from the fact that it represents this basic, this extremely unequal distribution of capacities. And again, so for him, if you try to rectify that in any fundamental sense, totalitarianism can be the only outcome, because it's framed in this context as an anti-natural move, right? But what I meant to say about his relationship to the alt-right and about this comment about Trump, for example, is that you were talking about dog whistling a little bit earlier. I mean, what Peterson, you know, basically his message to the alt-right, as far as I can tell, is you guys are right in your description of reality, right? You know, the severe inequality that you essentialize, you know, as a condition of existence that is real. But what Peterson is saying is, but I don't agree with the political conclusions that you draw from it, right? So again, there's this Jungian sort of notion, right? We said about the aristocratic view of nature and the inveterate Democrat, right? Well, we should, you know, it's like this kind of superego, right? You know, well, we should, you know, still sort of have something like, you know, some kind of liberalism, right? Or some kind of, you know, formal legal or political equality, right? So there's always that. I just want to say that, yeah, you know, there's always, and this is very psychoanalytic, but there's always that conscious, unconscious divide, right? That contradiction in Peterson's work.
Yeah, it's interesting, that relationship to the alt-right. I would agree with you that he's actually, I mean, he's ultimately a sort of illiberal liberal in a lot of ways.
We use that word, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that I would call him a fascist, and I know some people have thrown that term out there, but I think the reason people jump to that conclusion is because a lot of his talking points are sort of based in this mythopoeticism that's like really inherent to fascism, but I'm not sure that I don't think that's a one-to-one correlation. I don't think that means, oh, Peterson is a fascist. I just think he's a really confused liberal.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard because you could argue that within liberalism, you know, some of the elements of fascism are latent already. I'm just going to say one thing I think about Peterson is, in a way, he perfectly articulates our political moment. Because if you look at, like, the far right and the way it functions today, you know, essentially it... you know, because I think this should, I've thought sometimes about writing a book about, you know, maybe a bit Derridian inspired, about the kind of the way that democracy isn't just a present concept, how it has to be thought of as like a futural and also past concept. So what I mean is, when you're making decisions, the question can't just be, do 51% of people support this right now? Right? That's not a good democratic faith, right? And of course, the whole idea that democracy is just votes, right? I mean, which even a lot of like Marxists really cleave to today, was basically an idea that was developed in the 19th century, you know, in the context of the bourgeois in different countries to kind of repress some of the spontaneous revolutionary energy that had characterized like the French Revolution. You know, in the context of the French Revolution, when you say democracy, it doesn't mean like voting. That's something that happens when you go out in the street, right? So, you know, and we see this, like, you know, even the Rousseauian notion of the volonté générale, right? It's like a lot more ambiguous, in terms of what that would mean. But I guess what I mean is, I think Peterson expresses our impasse in a very clear way, because if you look at, the far right today, you know, what they essentially attempt to do is to instrumentalize democracy in order to pursue ends which are antagonistic toward the development of the enhancement of democracy within the society. Right. So, you know, 51% of people want to fuck the other 49%, you know, okay, so let's do that, right? You know, I mean, obviously this is, you know, this may be democratic in the literal sense, right? But it's absolutely not democratic in spirit, right? So, you know, I think Peterson, there's a structural symmetry between that sort of, those sort of politics and his work, in the way that, you know, again, you have very, very anti-democratic aspects. And of course, we knew, you know, early on, Jung was a Nazi sympathizer, and you know, Heidegger, obviously, who Peterson misinterprets quite methodically.
Real quickly, I was going to mention too. You mentioned that he's really interested in the Pareto principle, and Pareto was well, he has a very dark history with fascists and sort of promoting social Darwinism. So yeah, they're strange bedfellows.
Yeah, no, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, I think probably half of Peterson's major references have some connection to fascism. You know, I mean, you know, he goes on about Solzhenitsyn, right? I mean, Solzhenitsyn was, you know, sort of briefly, you know, a kind of poster boy for, you know, human freedoms and American liberals, right? In the 60s, before people kind of realized how deep the rabbit hole kind of went with him in terms of his own vociferous anti-Semitism and everything.
You know, I wanted to mention that really, really quickly to you, and I hope I'm not interrupting, but have you seen the video of Peterson where he's asked about Solzhenitsyn, where this person in the audience says, "What about that book on that Solzhenitsyn wrote about the
Bolshevik
Jews
Jewish
and
one?
Communism?"
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and he actually does exactly what you said earlier. He has that pained expression on his face, and he's contorting his face, and he just stops and he says, "I can't do it. I can't do it." And then he moves on to the next topic. And I'm like, that was the point where I was like, I don't know how anyone takes this guy seriously. But like you said, there is that sort of dramatic oration that sort of makes him I guess that's resonant with a lot of people. But yeah, Solzhenitsyn's connection to anti-Semitism is very well known.
Yeah, well, and so, I just want to say one thing about that presentation. I do actually have a footnote that describes that. I have 8 pages of footnotes, and I think Matt remarked that it was almost David Foster Wallace like the kind of, in there I talk about that. You know, what's interesting with that too, if we're going to talk about dog whistling, is that of course he had the opportunity to dismiss this thesis, right there. It was a very clear opportunity to do that, right? But instead of dismissing this thesis, right, which is clearly an anti-Semitic thesis. Now, I'm not saying that there wasn't a disproportionate influence by persons of Jewish descent on the Russian Revolution. But, the way that this is analyzed by Solzhenitsyn is anti-Semitic. Peterson had the opportunity to dismiss that. Instead of dismissing it, right, what he does, is he waltzes around the stage, with a look of intense seriousness on his face, as if it's something that warrants this kind of consideration. And then at the end, he waves the question off as if, it's quite ambiguous, right? Is he saying that I don't disagree? I just don't feel that it's possible to talk about this in a public forum. And there's often those kind of signals, that he sends to people, the alt-right, let's say.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I just want to say quickly, you can continue in a minute. I just want to say quickly, it would just be, it's very interesting to know, for someone who, immediately attempts to conflate any kind of left-wing expression with the excesses of Stalinism, it's amazing how comparatively relaxed he is in citing and using the work of thinkers who have, even clearer associations with fascism.
Yeah, one of the other weird things with regards to anti-Semitism was, I remember he released like a statement on his blog or his website where he addressed all these alt-right kids that were contacting him about Kevin MacDonald, who's this evolutionary psychologist that, I would say he's like a 60s acid casualty that just thinks Jews rule the world through some evolutionary group strategy. He's absolutely, in my view, out there.
Yeah.
But he was like addressing his fans who kept asking him about Kevin MacDonald. And I was just thinking to myself, Kevin MacDonald is such a fringe figure. Why are you even like putting his name up on your website and talking about him? And the other thing is, how do you have so little self-reflection not to think to yourself, well, this is kind of maybe a bad thing. I'm attracting all these people who connect my work to an anti-Semitic evolutionary psychologist who believes in like a Protocols of Zion conspiracy updated with biology. Or pseudoscience biology.
He knows what he's doing, right? That's clear. And it's very interesting. Like if you look at his book that we reviewed, destroyed, what is it? Savage Messiah, How Dr. Jordan Peterson is Saving Western Civilization. That's actually the title, by the way.
Title. That Jim Posner book, that biography of him, I was like, he's a messiah? Oh my god, if he's the messiah, we're screwed. Whew.
Yeah, well, I made a point at the end of my review, and I made a kind of joke. I said, Peterson plays this kind of game of disavowal, right? So, for instance, he met Prosser and approved this book, right? But he did so in such a way that, and Prosser in this book, he's openly misogynistic, he laments the onset of anti-white racism and all of this. And Prosser's just written articles about how women have a last fuckable day and all this stuff. But Peterson does so in a way where there's a kind of plausible deniability about his involvement in these things. So I made a joke at the end of the review and I said, Prosser compares Peterson to Jesus, but maybe Prosser should be compared to Jesus because, you know, Jesus let himself get pinned down. I'm like, that's, yeah, you know, I mean, clearly Peterson knows what he's doing with these things. And I think that actually this, he courted this audience. It's not an accident, right? You know, so not only will he defend them, right? I remember him talking about the comments on his YouTube videos, and he goes, people criticize the people who comment on my YouTube videos. But, you know, if you ever seen anything else on the internet, I've went in and looked at those YouTube comments and they're pretty good. You know, people are pretty sophisticated, you know? And of course, if you actually go in his YouTube videos, they're loaded with kind of anti-Semitic bile and, you know, misogyny and so forth. But again, I want to stress that he actually courted this audience, right? So that would be my theory anyway. It seems to me 12 Rules for Life went through a really long editorial process, like 2.5 years. And I think what happened was with the Professor Against Political Correctness scandal in 2016, that he became this kind of, you know, he was talked about in places like 4chan. He became sort of an alt-right sensation. And then my personal interpretation, and I can't, you know, I can't verify this. It's hard to prove. But my personal interpretation is that that they went back and heavily edited 12 Rules for Life to put content in it that would appeal more to that kind of audience. Well, you know, without making openly racist statements in the book or anything like that. And by the way, I'm not saying that Peterson, you know, if he were just off mic briefly, he would, you know, it's more complex than that, right? But, you know, I do characterize him, you know, as, you know, if not a fascist, I think there's a very, very clear element, sense in which he has a strong sympathy for those kind of ideas.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the Prosser book, Savage Messiah, how Dr. Jordan Peterson is saving Western civilization. Again, I just want to note that title just boggles my mind, and like it scares me because I'm like, I forget who said it. Someone said, you know, Jordan Peterson is not the intellectual we need, but he must be the one we deserve. And I was fascinated to see that your review of Prosser's book got like heavy pushback from at least one author who said, you know, oh, this was a vicious criticism of Jordan Peterson. I was wondering if you could just respond to maybe the outrage over your having written a review about that book.
Well, I mean, I responded. I wrote an article about that, and I responded, and of course there was more pushback. I mean, Marian West has a strong pro-Peterson faction, which is also why it's useful to write about Peterson there, because it communicates to an audience of people who are interested in his work. And, you know, in true Petersonian form, the backlash it engenders tends to actually boost our publicity. So thank you, everyone who wrote inflammatory comments about me, thank you. Yeah, about that, about the viciousness, that was Cambus Tavenagh. Yeah, I mean, I made the point in the article that I responded in. I basically, you know, and Tavenagh's article was just, you know, it's just a gallery of fallacious straw man arguments. It's just comically awful. But, you know, I made the point that, you know, there's a kind of misconception. You know, Tavenagh writes in this almost condescending kind of faux benevolent tone, right? Like, we are the vicious ones. You know, it's the way to disrespecting an author. I mean, the most disrespectful thing you can do to an author, it's not being harsh, right? You know, or an intellectual. It's refusing to engage with the substance of their arguments, right? You know, and Tavenagh just, you know, what he showed in that piece was that, you know, he couldn't be bothered to read and digest anything we'd written on the subject, right? You know, he employed some allegory from Sartre, you know, and he talks about kind of the perils of left-wing totalitarianism. So there's a certain irony.
Sartre. Wasn't Sartre a Marxist for most of his life?
Yeah. I mean, that was someone else wrote it. Someone, I didn't even point that out because it just seems so obvious. I refuse to address the allegory. But yeah, you know, rife with irony. But I mean, so he used a thing from Sartre, and he talks about how it showed the, you know, how left-wing thought degenerates. And, you know, and just to give you an example of the kind of errors in here, at one point he said, like, we know that welfare states, you know, have a strong tendency to become totalitarian communist states. I just wrote in my response, man, that's never happened once. Like, you know, I mean, China, Cuba, Russia, these were all like feudal or semi-feudal and aristocratically governed. prior to communism, which might alert a keener thinker to the fact that the cause of autocracy in those nations wasn't purely communism. I've talked to Tavani. He seems like a nice guy. I don't engage with that because I think, you know, I mean, my reasons for engaging that have probably somewhat cynically have to do with trying to reach an audience before this book comes out. You know, a lot of this stuff I don't necessarily consider so valuable in terms of the points that are brought forth.
Well, I brought up that review by Tabana as well, or that response to your review, because I noticed in it they bring up this whole equality of outcome versus equality of opportunity, and we can't have equality of outcome. And, you know, I always reference on this show, have you ever read Kurt Vonnegut at all, the fiction author?
I mean, are you going to talk about the thing where he talks about the Committee of Equality, or this thing where everything has to be equalized, right? Is that it?
Harrison Bergeron, the handicapper general, forces everyone to be equal in this story, Harrison Bergeron.
Okay, so, I think I've read that story, yeah.
It's fascinating because a lot of conservatives like it. And the basis of the story is that there's a handicapper general who – if you're beautiful, the handicapper general makes you wear a mask. If you're very tall, you have to be as short as the other people. So they bust your kneecaps and force you to be on your knees at all times. And I'm like, the funny thing about that story is that Vonnegut is actually making fun of this idea that, oh, left-wingers all just want to force us to be equal in ways that aren't possible. I have never met a left-winger who would say, oh, if we achieved socialism, everyone's going to have the same outcome. Because even within a socialist system, obviously people would have different kinds of parents. People would end up, you know, coming out differently just based on how society is configured. I always thought that this equality of outcome thing was a bit of a straw man, to be honest.
Yeah, I discussed that too. I basically, you know, I point out that, you know, Marx in the Paris Manuscripts, he says that, you know, Marx says the problem with capitalism is that it obscures, other differences between people. So, you know, you're ugly, but you can buy the most beautiful wife and so on. So Marx was very clear, you know, you're stupid, but you can pay people to advise you. But Marx was quite clear that he felt that, you know, the sort of social relation of capital was obscuring or preventing the rise of anything like a meritocracy. Right. Now, you know, that actually gets kind of interesting, because then when you get into like social reproduction theory and stuff like that, when you kind of reverse engineer Marxism, you can kind of say, well, you know, why do we think certain people are more beautiful than others? And how is that connected to social class?
Are you referencing Bourdieu at all?
Yeah. Bourdieu, for example.
Right? I'm a big fan of Bourdieu. So.
Yeah. Distinction. Great book. Yeah. Right. But I mean, yeah, like the thing is like, but part of the problem with all this is it just conflates a lot of things. You know, so like, you know, Peterson just sees the left as about equality of outcome. Right. You know, and like, it's like, you know, when you make it, when you use the simplistic binary, you know, it's like you could have used the exact same argument to oppose the abolition of slavery. Right. I mean, it's just like, oh, you guys want equality of outcome. Right. Like, you know, it's extremely inspecific. I mean, Marx, obviously, in the most explicit sense, Marx is criticizing not, you know, all forms of inequality, right? He's criticizing the material inequalities that are characteristic of the class system that exists because of capitalism, or the existence of capital, if we want to even go before that, right? You know, that's what he's talking about. Peterson, and the other thing about this is like, it's like, so you're right, right, that this is a straw man. But the other thing about it is, it's like, you know, he talks about equality of opportunity, and it's like, man, where the hell does that exist? Like, you know, Zizek in his debate with Peterson, Zizek was quite content to say the only aspiration I would have is to bring about equality of opportunity. Well, that's because we're very far away from equality of opportunity. I mean, who would look at, you know, Beverly Hills, you know, and some ramshackle third world community in Rwanda and think that there's equality of opportunity between those places? So, you know, on this basis, the most axiomatic and fundamental demand of the left for a greater and more equitable redistribution of wealth can easily be subsumed under the maxim of equality of opportunity, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's one of the reasons. I mean, you know, in some ways, I'm still surprised that Peterson has gotten so popular. And I agree with you. It's because of his ability to orate, and maybe he has a certain X factor, a certain charisma. But when it comes to like conservative or reactionary thinkers, I just find him. I find him boring, to be honest. Like, you know, even someone who I consider a crackpot, like Nicholas Nassim Taleb, like at least Taleb will say, oh, well, you know, IQ doesn't matter as much as these people think, and a lot of things are just based on luck. And then he comes to the weird conclusion of, yeah, but we need skin in the game and there should be no social safety nets, despite saying that everything isn't based on merit. Like, at least he'll engage with that idea that there are factors involved in why we end up in our class position that don't relate to something like IQ. I find Peterson's thought to be, I don't want to say lazy, because maybe I'm being too harsh and I'm not engaging it fairly enough. I've never been impressed by it.
Well, again, one of the things I try to address, and actually I don't make this point in the book, it's something I thought about later, but I do make related points in the book. But one thing I said, I try to address him as a cultural phenomenon. You know, and I think one thing that's important to stress, you know, Marshall McLuhan, right? Great thinker, right? And I think Baudrillard plagiarized most of his best ideas from McLuhan. And I like repping that because I'm from near Toronto, you know. But McLuhan said, you know, the medium is the message. That's what everyone knows about McLuhan. It's the one thing. But it's useful here. Because you know, I think the truth about Peterson is that, you know, we might be missing the point should we talk about, you know, how strong are his arguments versus this person or that person, because I think so much of his success is based on, I mean, not just obviously, you know, the existence of these kind of parallel right-wing movements that are enthusiastic for some kind of intellectual legitimation, but also the particular emergence of video as a medium of philosophical communication. I take 12 Rules for Life as being one of these, and I mean, even to say 12 Rules for Life is to, but that period of Peterson's career in which 12 Rules for Life was released, as being a kind of game changer, in the same way that, I'm going to cite really culturally celebrated works, right? So, you know, I'm not trying to say he's a genius or something. But, you know, being a game changer with respect to medium and communication, you know, in the way of like Wizard of Oz being in color or Michael Jackson using videos are. And what I mean by that is I think that, you know, like you got to understand, like 12 Rules for Life is almost more like a tour souvenir. Right. I mean, you know, what Peterson's real success comes from his YouTube videos. Right. You know, and in that respect, his real success is related not necessarily to what he's communicating, but to how he's communicating. And how compelling he is to view.
I was going to say, if you're a kid in college, which professor are you going to be interested in? The one that's like telling you about the history of existentialist philosophy, or the one that's relating everything back to Lion King?
Of course. Yeah. I've seen that. Yeah. The day. It's a day is like a journey. It's like the journée in French. Brilliant. What does he say? The rock is the dawn of consciousness. The sun is the dawn of consciousness. Like, I just discuss it. It's like stuff that anyone would know, right? Like, but okay, these are the fundamental truths of our, and you know, that's actually one of the worst things about Peterson is just the tremendous banalization of like social existence that comes across in his work. Like, you know, he produces the most kind of, you know, often really, really, you know, just this kind of, very, very traditional and boring in many respects, you know, interpretations of, you know, literature or Western history or his commentaries in politics or whatever, you know.
Well,
and
the
then,
meaning
then
of this great piece of literature is that you should clean your room.
Yeah. Like, you know, okay. The meaning of this is that, you know, you have to seize your, you know, Simba has to seize his destiny, you know, and that's one thing the left always forgets. You know, you can't just stay, you know, in Hakuna Matata, you know, it's like, okay, like, you know, okay. But, you know, these aren't, I'm not saying there aren't things about interesting, that there aren't interesting things about Peterson, but, you know, when he gets into that, you know, heavy recitation of kind of Western narrative archetypes, Jung and so on. You know, it's like he's presenting these very, very banal renditions of this material, you know, as if it's like a world epochal significance, right? So this also speaks to the kind of weird disproportion I said in terms of his experiences in academia, right? Like, it's as if, like, you know, in a more, I don't want to say Marxist, but in a more left-wing environment, let's say, you know, it's as if by saying what everyone else doesn't bother saying, because, you know, it's either, like, you know, inadequate to address, you know, the complexity of our reality, or just self-evident, you know, that he is the prophet, right, who can deliver us, right, from these deviant, you know, postmodern neo-Marxists, right? So that's, yeah.
Before you go, there were just two more things I wanted to cover, if you have the time.
Sure, you know, I have probably 35 minutes, as much as you need.
Okay, awesome. So one of the most interesting aspects of your portion of the book is what I would call Derrida contra Peterson. I'm going to ask that maybe you tell my listeners a little bit about Derrida and his thinking, and why Peterson is so interested in Derrida and what you call his non-reading of Derrida.
Yeah, well, you're lucky. You're lucky that I remember most of this stuff, because I always like Deleuze. At one point, they asked him to talk about something he wrote, you know, a few years earlier, and he said, you know, I literally only know what I'm doing at this point in time. but no, I do remember partly because of these engagements. But I just wanted to say that about that. So Peterson, I mean, there's a famous quote: "Il n'y a pas les autres textes," right? There's no outside text by Derrida. And, you know, this has been, you know, insofar as it's been kind of a motto that's attached itself to Derrida, you know, people often will endeavor to interpret his philosophy in relation to this. You know, the biggest charge leveled against Derrida in the West, you know, is he's that the proponent of this kind of pernicious relativism that has, you know, torn across our institutions of higher learning and had a kind of corrupting influence. Peterson continues in this tradition, right? Though Peterson puts a particular spin on it in 12 Rules for Life. So in 12 Rules for Life, Peterson says that Derrida thinks everything is interpretation. And then, you know, so he wants to link up, right, postmodernism and Marxism, basically polemically, so that he can attribute to postmodernism, like, you know, the Stalinist, you know, killings or whatever, Pol Pot or whatever. And what Peterson says is that, and I'm not kidding you here, what he says is that he claims that, you know, Derrida's assertion of the construction of reality by language is, you know, essentially manifests as the theory that, you know, everything is defined by power, or the power constructs everything about our reality. So he seems to actually confuse Foucault and Derrida. And again, the fact that these corrections the fact that these things were never corrected, I think further illustrates my point about how the intention of 12 Rules for Life was not to create a credible philosophical text, but was to create a text that could resonate with a mass audience and also with an alt-right audience that had taken a great interest in his work. But as for Derrida himself, so what I deal with now, you know, I wouldn't say that it's not like Peterson's interpretation is 100% wrong, right? Certainly that you could argue that there's a strong linguistically relative element in Derrida. So basically, you know, what Derrida was arguing, right? And I'm not a Derrida scholar or anything, but it's been a while. It's been a year over a year since I wrote the book. But basically what Derrida makes the argument in Of Grammatology that, and it's pursued through critique of Claude Lévi-Strauss and also Rousseau, and Rousseau, I think, mostly for sort of political purposes in terms of le patrimoine français. What Derrida argues is that there's always a pretension, and you can see it within structuralism, like the concept of the third order within structuralism. The idea that in structuralism that, you know, you have this Coirean idea, for example, that exists in even Lacan, that, okay, you know, we can use mathematics, and then we can kind of abstract ourselves from reality, right? And it's like a search for a methodology that can be used to circumscribe the structure of social reality. And what Derrida's book, you know, of grammatology is above all a critique of is that sort of pretension, right? So what he critiques in the work in general is you can talk about what you call like the metaphysics of presence, right? So the idea that, you know, culture, you know, and it's funny because it's not just a philosophy critique, because the ideas he's critiquing are so expansive that they converge with, you know, questions of how we live our everyday lives in quite a direct sense. But Derrida essentially, what he does is he critiques this notion whereby we have the idea that there's a presence which is authoritative, right? You know, like a common sense, right? Like a kind of empirical thinking. You know, that's kind of just the way things are. And he critiques this through an analytic of the relationship between speech and writing. And in philosophical discourses, the historical privilege that's been assigned to the domain of speech over writing is being representing a kind of artifice. And, you know, essentially what he wants to claim is that, you know, any kind of not just oppositional structure, but furthermore, any kind of, let's say, structuralist motivated attempt to get out of that kind of oppositional binary and to realize a kind of third order is already conditioned by a kind of metaphysical construction. And so what he shows is the way that all of Western philosophy is kind of based on the idea that there's a possibility of obtaining some kind of escape, right? This kind of signification, right? So in a way, you can take this as being having strongly relativistic elements. I don't dispute that. But what
doesn't he have like a saying? You know, he's always talking about the break in the linguistic chain is what I always hear Derrida saying.
Yeah. The sort of rupture. And I think, well, you know, in a lot of what he's searching for, right, are like the moment where a certain kind of significant structure kind of collapses and betrays its own contradiction, right? You know, the limits of kind of linearizing reality in that way. Probably maybe some Derrida scholars will object to this characterization. If so, they can email me and complain. But I don't dispute that there are certain relativizing aspects to that thesis. What I get into, and this is the most kind of academic part of the book, actually, Matt suggested that we take this part out and publish it as a separate article because he thought it strayed quite far from, you know, sort of a core discussion of Peterson. But what I basically point out is that Derrida delivered a seminar, I believe, in 1975 called Le Mort et la Vie, like life and death, or life death, to be more accurate. And essentially what he experiments with or what he toys with is the idea of applying these sort of deconstructive schemas to the domain of biology and sexual reproduction, which is just interesting because it suggests that if that's the case, then, you know, then you kind of have to read Derrida in a different way, right? Because that's sort of a strongly ontological reading of Derrida. And actually, my supervisor is Catherine Malibu, who's a student of Derrida. You know, she wrote L'Avenir de Hegel, The Future of Hegel, which is a well-known sort of thesis, well-known text, and he wrote the foreword for that. But I've read 100 pages, right? Like it's Derrida. but you see in her work, right, in terms of neuroplasticity and the kind of projects that she pursues, that a lot of I think I would understand much of Malibu's project as being representing a kind of ontologization or effort to think the notion of deconstruction, not so much in a linguistic and relativistic sense. This isn't the strongest criticism of Peterson in the book. It's something I also put forth for my own exegetical reasons. But I think it's just interesting to raise that question of to what extent can we accept this kind of caricature of Derrida's purely linguistic relativist, right?
Yeah, well, I wanted to bring it up because, I mean, I think it's possible to be very critical of postmodernist thinkers. I think, in fact, that, you know, a lot of Marxists are not fans of postmodernists, mm-hmm. which yeah. is why I find postmodern neo-Marxism to be a weird contradiction in terms. But I find it aggravating that I don't think Peterson takes, you know, I'm more familiar with Foucault's work, for instance. I don't think he gives a fair shake to thinkers like Foucault or Derrida, for that matter. And it's always agitated me about Peterson, probably more than it should.
Yeah. Well, again, I think that, you know, like this is, if we're talking about writing, which I think, you know, it's a, as Derrida says, right, it's assigned a certain authority in our society. Oh, no, that's speech, right? But in a different way. Okay, but writing does have a certain authority as well in its own way. Okay, but if we're talking about writing, right, you know, the most thorough treatment of this issue by Peterson of postmodern neo-Marxism is in 12 Rules for Life. And again, I don't know if you've read it. It's like it emerges. It's like it's just slotted into some tangent about how, like, it's slotted into a chapter. You know, it's a tangent or a digression in a chapter about how you should pet cats or not stop kids from skateboarding or something. But again, it has a clearly polemical function, right? And I said this again, the polemical function what he says basically is that, like, the Marxist theory of oppression by class or oppression by capital is just swapped out by postmodernists for, like, a far more general scheme of oppression. You know, so you can say, well, it's power or it's, like, language itself or something like that, right? And Peterson, you know, characterizes this as a strategy that was adopted by the left to distance themselves from the negative publicity that was being accrued by the Soviet Union, you know, in the 1960s with the revolution of the gulag or revelation of the gulags and so forth. Right. So again, I think the crispness or the rigor of the academic treatment is quite secondary to how that to that polemical drive. Right?
And also, before you go, Zizek versus Peterson. What were your thoughts upon seeing Zizek versus Peterson? I know that you cover it pretty well in the book.
Yeah. Well, I mean. You know, I mean, I think, and I actually have some. There's some information in that book that I got from Russell Siglibria, who was he works a bit with Zizek, and he picked him up and drove him to the debate. And you know, it's funny. Actually, he told me a story about how, you know, I mean, like, Zizek's people got totally beaten in the negotiation. Like, Peterson agreed to organize the stream, you know, and then took all the money for the stream, of course, and then Zizek went and donated all of the only revenue stream he got from it, which is a speaking fee. He went and donated all of that to an Indigenous children's charity, right? I mean, he was talking about kind of the surreality of going in, because, you know, Zizek came in and he said, like, Peterson, you know, Zizek just came in, like, whatever, he's got, like, a stain on his shirt, you know, he's kind of sniffling, you know, it's just him and, like, you know, some you know, early career academic. And Peterson, by contrast, had, like, this kind of tour bus, you know, and all these guys and, like, you know, suits, you know, with sort of like a impeccably maintained facial hair or whatever. You know, and there was a real, you know, and you see this actually with Peterson, right? If you look at all the different ventures he hops on, we have a lot of information that we couldn't publish in the book, right? Because of legal risks and so forth. But we have a lot of information about Peterson's different financial ventures and some of the dubiosities associated with them. But again, I, you know, I'm not making that as a, like, okay, I've said that, right? So we're here, we're on air. But, you know, it's not something I would feel comfortable putting into a public domain, especially given the limitations of our research resources. But I just meant to say that, you know, it's very, very clear that there's a very, very well-oiled kind of machine Peterson has, you know, and there's a very, very strong drive to, you know, kind of monetize and economize his writings and performances.
You know, he's actually said before, I forget which interview he said it in, but Peterson actually said, "I've monetized the SJWs." It's actually really funny when you think about it.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, again, it wasn't just National Post. It was kind of the interplay, right? When he first broke through in 2016, it was like the National Post would run something, and then, you know, BuzzFeed would run something that was really outraged. And it was that back and forth that really built him up. But I just mean to say about the debate, You know, I mean, what's clear is that Žižek didn't come with a serious intention to debate Peterson's views. I mean, they asked him, the Toronto Star asked him about it beforehand. His response was basically that, they asked him, are you reading Peterson's work? And he said, I'm not really reading his work, right? Like, what I'm thinking about is how I'm going to present my argument in a way that's going to be accessible to a large number of people. Peterson came in with his sort of, you know, grade 10 level reading of the Communist Manifesto or whatever, which I take on the grunt work in my section of actually refuting, you know, quite decisively. Žižek just rather quickly kind of changed the channel. And I think, you know, I think actually, you know, it depends what you're trying to achieve. I mean, I think if Žižek had wanted to, like, you know, kind of in the agonistic parlance of the alt-right, you know, sort of destroy Peterson, you know, like porn headings, right? I think if he'd wanted to do that, he could have, you know. I mean, like, these guys are at a different level, right? You know, this is clear. And again, I'm not saying Peterson's an idiot. It's just Žižek is Žižek. I mean, you know, legitimately, let's say, one of the most interesting thinkers of our time, whatever his shortcomings as well. But I think what he recognized was that, I understand him to be, he was basically making a pitch to Peterson fans, right? And what he was trying to do was he was sort of saying, well, look, you know, you hate political correctness, so do I, right? But just because you have this disdain for, you know, kind of fashionable postmodern academics or the liberal left or whatever, Sleepy Joe or Crooked Hillary or whatever it may be, doesn't mean that you have to go to Peterson as the option, right? And I think Žižek actually, in the foreword he wrote for our book, right, that's another thing to mention is the book has a foreword by Slavoj Žižek, which I was just stunned that he actually did, you know. He writes in the foreword, he says, you know, some people got frustrated with me because I didn't, you know, go after Peterson, right? And he says that, you know, he says there are two reasons why I didn't do that. He said one is because there are certain aspects of his work, which I genuinely appreciate. He said, above all, his clinical work. You know, I think Peterson has some good clinical work. I want to be fair because I've criticized the guy a lot here, and I think there's a lot to criticize. But if something I think is good, I will say it.
You've been much nicer about it than I have been.
Well, I think, you know, Žižek says I appreciate his clinical work. I appreciate his opposition to political correctness. But Žižek also adds that, you know, as regards our other disagreements, he said, I view the difference as being so self-evident that it's not something that even has to be spelled out. Right. And then it's actually interesting because if you look at the result of that debate. Now, you know, Žižek could have taken another tack. Right. I mean, you know, Peterson makes, you know, like, at best, his arguments are oversimplified. At worst, they're just categorically wrong. I mean, at one point, he says, like, Marx views all of history as just being a struggle between the bourgeois and the proletariat. He's like, we know there's lots of other social classes. And it's like, well, Marx actually thought of that as, like, you know, in the abstract kind of model of capital, for example. When Marx says in the Communist Manifesto that society is more and more becoming defined by the opposition between bourgeois and proletariat as other classes become subsumed into that division. Right. So he very explicitly doesn't say that all of history, right, is a division between bourgeois and proletariat. And there's plenty of evidence to that effect scattered throughout Marx's work. So that's just one example. Right. Like, there's several examples of this. I mean, you know, he does the thing where he says, you know, Marx attributes all, you know, wants to abolish all inequalities or views them as related to capitalism. It's like, again, he didn't say that. Like, you know,
didn't Žižek at one point just start talking? I think he said, ah, but what about the critique of the Gotha program? What about that? And Peterson was just like, what? I don't know what that is.
Well, that's actually funny about the debate, too, because Peterson, like, I think before he did the debate, he said, like, I haven't read the Communist Manifesto since I was 16 or something like that. And it's like, man, given that you've just been, like, been banging on about Marx for, like, nonstop for the past, like, 3 years, you think you could have been bothered to, like, pick up a book and double check it or something? like, you know, that also is very, very... That's very, very indicative with respect to rigor. You know, I mean, this like, Žižek could have went on about those things, but he didn't. And he took a different approach. And I think, you know, like, the question of who won or lost the debate is a little bit extraneous in this context. I think what's clear is that Zizek's strategy succeeded, you know, on its own terms. Right. So I was curious to see what the responses to the debate were, and I went and looked at some of these sort of Peterson fan groups, you know, which I like to keep on some of them to follow the news. You know, sometimes they find me, who find out who I am and ban me. Right. Yeah, I looked at one of them, and, you know, it was interesting to see the feedback. And a lot of people were like, you know, because Peterson had shown a certain appreciation for Zizek, the sophistication of Zizek's points in the argument. And, you know, and that translated to a lot of his fans. So if you looked at a lot of these groups and so forth online, you know, a lot of his fans were saying, yeah, you know, Zizek's interesting, you know, and Zizek was talking about Christianity and all this stuff. Right. Like you saw that, you know, they both have this big interest in religion. I think Zizek's only honorary degree is like in theology. A lot of the fans were saying, well, look, yeah, obviously this guy isn't the same as, you know, the people we really hate. Right? You could be cynical about that. And you could say, like, well, Zizek should have, you know, came up with a more forceful response or whatever, and he shouldn't have been concerned with endearing himself in any way to Peterson's fans. But there's a more positive way of taking that too, which is like, you know, are some of these fans now going to pick up a copy of, you know, First His Tragedy, Then His Farce, or, you know, I don't know, Ticklish Subject or something like that, and take a look and see if they like it. And if that's the case, you know, I mean, it's one of those cultural things, right? It's like Joe Rogan endorsing Bernie Sanders, you know, and it's like, you know, some people were like, oh, he should have rejected that endorsement. But look, I'm not saying there's a time and a place to severely and ruthlessly criticize the alt-right. But, you know, I also think that especially maybe when people, you know, haven't fully developed their opinions. A lot of Peterson's fans are very young, obviously. You know, one would hope that one could at least permit the possibility of some kind of conversion occurring as well.
Well, I would just add to that. And I mean, I have complex feelings towards Zizek. When I started reading Zizek, I was probably more on the right. So he sort of helped me get out of that right-wing mind space. There's mm-hmm. a lot of things I disagree with him about in more recent years, and that's fine. But I liked his approach in so much as... That debate was the one debate I've seen where Peterson didn't know how to respond. He was very, very tripped up. I think he said at one point, I thought we were going to debate happiness. And Savoy just was like, no, I go and make my point. I want to make this point. And it, in a way, I think it was the one time I saw that Peterson really did not know what to do.
Well, it reminded me of, you know, the Mikhail Tal, the chess player. He once said, you know, even describing his playing style, because he used very complex variations, you know, he said, I like to take my opponents into a deep, dark forest where 2 and 2 equals 5 and where nothing is as it seems. You know, he was talking about this kind of strategy he used to sort of baffle, to use variations that were so exotic and creative, it kind of baffled the other players rather than relying on, you know, sheer robustness of traditional approaches. Right. And I think that was in large part what happened in the debate. I mean, Zizek, partly because I think he just didn't want to prepare, to be clear, partly because I think he just didn't want to bother reading all of Peterson or something. But, you know, following his own strategy, I mean, Zizek kind of went and made his own points, you know, and then there were these moments of convergence where they would more sprinkle throughout the debate, where they would really, their work would come more clearly into confrontation. But Zizek kind of made his points. You know, I just think at a certain, you know, at a certain point, it's just very hard for Peterson to keep up with that. But at a certain point, Peterson was really scrambling, right? Because the intellectual density of Zizek's arguments, you know, I think it's too much for Peterson to really deal with, right? And I think it'd be hard for anyone, right? But I said Peterson's not in the same weight class, I think, as an intellectual, and that became quite clear in the debate, right? I don't think that, you know, certainly were there an intellectual making similarly complex arguments, who were seated, you know, about philosophy or psychology or whatever, who was seated aside Zizek. I don't think Zizek would find it impossible to respond if he wanted to, right? But Peterson really was struggling there.
Well, you know, my favorite thing to come out of the debate, and then I'll let you go, is, well, this story is probably apocryphal, but I just found it very funny and could believe it, was that supposedly Zizek got to meet Peterson's daughter, Michaela, and he just said, "Ah, so you are the meat girl." And, I hope that's true, because that would be, what the kids call a king move. I thought it was an interesting debate, and I actually think Myth and Mayhem is a very interesting book. As I said at the beginning, I think sometimes a lot of people online especially may overstate Peterson, but I think it's worth engaging with Peterson on some level or thinking about why he's gotten so popular. And I think the book does a good job of providing a pretty clear critique.
Yeah, and I think also that, you know, it's one thing about it is that I think, you know, one thing I'm proud of about the book, and I thought the book turned out well, you know, on the whole. But one thing, you know, and I was very, very, you know, dogged about how I went about my section. It was like 5 weeks, you know, just doing that. One thing about, which is a long section, by the way, you know, my section of the book is longer than Capitalist Realism by about 6,000 words. Just by way of random comparison, important zero text, right? One thing about, that, is that I think actually it's a book that I encourage, Peterson fans to pick up as well. And hopefully some will, I suspect actually a lot will, but hopefully, you know, I want to have some humility here. Hopefully some will. I think that, and one thing I think about it is I think, in many ways, because, you know, the thing is, like, Peterson often, you know, he just makes a lot of sort of proclamations about the way, you know, the structure of reality or this or that. I think, and also the other thing is that a lot of Peterson is decontextualized, right? So, of course, you have different Petersons, right? You have kind of the Peterson of the Zizek Peterson debate. You have the Peterson of the books. You have the Peterson of, you know, speaking to all right-leaning audiences on YouTube and so forth. You know, one thing I feel about the book is that it offers a fairly well-researched and quite expansive profile of, which is easier to do because he emerged just a few years ago, profile of all of his kind of activities. You get everything kind of addressed in there, right? From the 2016 scandal, like I said, the debate, you know, different speaking venues he's been at, you know, all kinds of things, his background in Alberta. It's very, very sweeping in that way. But the other thing I think is good about it is that his arguments are discussed maybe, you know, because again, Zizek's strategy, for instance, wasn't to engage so much with Peterson directly. In terms of direct engagement, I think probably a lot of his arguments are discussed at a higher level of intellectual density in our book than maybe they ever have been before. Right? I mean, maybe you could find certain pieces, but certainly in anything resembling a sustained treatment, right? So, you know, I think actually, you know, even if you're, you know, the authors vary in their attitudes toward Peterson. Maybe, you know, I think with Matt and I, who wrote the biggest sections, it's a bit of maybe good cop, bad cop. You know, I'm a little tougher. But, and, you know, Matt makes good points, but, you know, he doesn't tend to mock as much. Again, I think it's something that that people will hopefully enjoy and hopefully gives a very broad view, like I said, of you know, who Peterson is and what he represents and you know, what the basis of these controversies has been.
Well, hey, Conrad Hamilton, one of the co-authors of the new Zero Books title, Myth and Mayhem, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Conrad Hamilton, co-author of Myth and Mayhem, a leftist critique of Jordan Peterson, available now from Zero Books. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. If you do join, we now have a Discord. So check that out if you're a Patreon supporter. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.